The announcement indicates that the tariff would be 25% on product, including Alaska seafood products.
China responds to U.S. tariffs with a tariff on Alaska seafood. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, frustration over a large backlog of Medicaid applications.
A number of people who would use choice four-letter words, and there are other people in tears.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
The U.S. today released a list of Chinese goods on which it will place 25% tariffs. Shortly afterward, China announced reciprocal tariffs on U.S. goods, including Alaska seafood. Garrett Everidge is an economist with the McDowell Group. He specializes in the seafood industry.
Our initial review of this indicates that really all salmon species, pollock, groundfish, herring, really across the board for Alaska seafood products, in addition to lobster and other products produced throughout the U.S. It looks like the announcement indicates that the tariff would be 25% on product, including Alaska seafood products.
Both U.S. and Chinese tariffs will reportedly take effect on July 6th. Everidge says it's too early to know what this will mean for the seafood market.
There's a whole other side of this with diplomacy and strategy on the side of China and the U.S. that we're not really aware of. But in the event that this actually occurs, it will certainly be a challenge to the industry, and it will impact processors, communities, fishermen, just because a 25% tariff means an increase in cost.
One thing is clear, however, China plays a major role in Alaska's seafood industry, so the tariffs would affect a significant portion of the market.
So in 2017, Alaska exported about 1.1 million metric tons of seafood to countries around the globe, and of this total, China accounted for a little bit less than half of that.
Everidge called these new tariffs large. They would be added to already existing tariffs on Alaska seafood entering China that vary from 5 to 15% depending on species. There are 20,000 unresolved applications for Alaskans waiting for Medicaid and other public assistance programs. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports that as the state is taking action to reduce the backlog, some people have been waiting for a long time.
Anchorage resident Jill Yorty has been waiting since January to learn whether her 5-year-old daughter, Raven, has qualified for Denali Kid Care. That's the state and federal program that provides health care to children in lower-income households, much like Medicaid does for adults. Yorty recently spent a day trying to learn more about Raven's application. Since she couldn't reach anyone on the phone, she waited in line at the Division of Public Assistance Anchorage office.
How are people supposed to keep jobs if they're required to stand in these lines all day without knowing when they'll be seen, without knowing when their case will get an answer? And you have to just stay there. You're chained to that office until your name is called, or you miss your chance.
Raven isn't alone. More than 15,000 applications have been waiting for more than 4 months to be processed. Some have it worse. 102 have been waiting for more than 3 years. The state leaders who work on public assistance say the size of the backlog overstates the number of people actually waiting. The state uses two different computer systems to handle the applications, and they don't always talk with each other when cases are resolved. Juneau resident Corey Paradovich has a unique perspective on the backlog. Until February, he worked in a Division of Public Assistance office, including answering phone calls from those in the backlog.
There were times when I had over 100 calls per day, and they are very upset. There were a number of people who would use choice four-letter words, and there were other people in tears.
Paratovich left the job and applied for Medicaid in February. Now he's part of the backlog. It's been a confusing experience.
I've received a letter saying that I am approved for Medicaid, I was not approved for Medicaid, and then I was approved for Medicaid. And all these letters came in at the same time.
On the other end of the process is Matt Stangley. He's been working on the backlog for the state. He says the job of processing the applications has been stressful. The attrition rate doubled after the backlog grew 4 years ago.
They take these positions because they want to help people in need, right? But that, you know, they're also human, so it's hard not to take this job home. And they realize that there's a large amount of work to be done, and they know the work that it takes to do that. So certainly that's going to weigh on them and increase the stress that they feel.
The state plans to hire 20 workers to handle the applications. The legislature approved half the 40 workers Governor Bill Walker's administration requested. Stangley hopes that having more workers will improve the morale for the rest of the workers and reduce the attrition rate.
We're grateful for the positions that we got, and we're going to do the absolute best that we can with them. And then obviously we'll report back to the legislature next year.
Stangley says the backlog began to grow when the Federal Affordable Care Act was rolled out. At the same time, a new state enrollment system wasn't ready. People applied, didn't hear back, and then they reapplied, adding to the backlog. Stangley says the state is working to speed up the applications for those with urgent needs. The state has hotlines to assist pregnant women and Alaskans requiring urgent care to apply for public assistance. Stangley says the division has emphasized meeting applicants in person rather than answering the phone. The new workers will be assigned to reduce the backlog and to rural offices. Jill Yorty won't be waiting much longer for Raven's Denali Kid Care application to be processed. They're moving to Colorado, where Yorty has family. She would have liked to have seen the legislature approve more workers to clear the backlog.
It sounds like a recipe for burnout to me for those employees.
Yorty is a former legislative aide who was statewide coordinator for Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. She says legislative candidates should do more for those in the backlog.
I think they need to spend at least one day of their campaign standing in line with everybody who's waiting to get assistance and hearing their stories and hearing the struggle that this backlog causes.
The state will start hiring the new workers in July. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Father's Day for those who've lost their dads.
At some point, people stop asking, and they shouldn't stop asking, right? Those are stories that are like deep inside of you, and like there should still be a way for those to come out.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The final and only public hearing outside of Alaska on the Department of Interior's plans to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling took place in Washington, D.C. today. Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin is at the meeting and joins us now. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Lori.
So, Liz, the meeting started at 4 p.m. on a Friday. How well attended is it? Set the scene for us.
Yeah, actually, it started at 4:30, and it's actually pretty well attended. There's a few hundred people. The environmental groups organized a protest out front beforehand, and so a lot of the attendees are wearing matching shirts that say Protect the Arctic Refuge, and it is really odd to have a government sponsored event starting at 4:30 on a Friday in Washington. You know, that's usually the time when the government issues press releases they want to bury. But Joe Balash, he's now an assistant secretary at Interior, he said, well, you know, it might be inconvenient for the professional activists, but the rank and file folk, a late meeting gives them a chance to come after work.
Liz, are there a lot of Alaskans in the crowd?
Yes, there were a lot of invited speakers who are Alaskans on both sides of the issue. We had like Sarah James, one of the Gwich'in leaders, Bernadette Dementiev, also Gwich'in, Richard Glenn from Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. A lot of Alaskans came as the featured speaker. Oh, also Andy Mack, Commissioner of Natural Resources.
What are you hearing from both sides? The meeting's been going on for a few hours now. What are you hearing?
Right. And up until now, it's been all the invited guests. So the public is just now, after a couple of hours, getting a chance to speak. And there's a few hundred people here. And so far, they've only announced that 40 will get to speak for 3 minutes each. So the public is just starting to talk, but an interview just chose someone in the crowd to speak to, and she was a retired teacher from Baltimore, and she just generally believes in protecting wild places. This was her first time coming to an event about the Arctic Refuge, and she said that since Donald Trump's election, she's been far more active in all kinds of marches and causes. And her feelings about the Arctic Refuge were quite general as just a wild place that she thought should be protected. And I did notice the general public has just started speaking, as I said, and I'm hearing a lot more about climate change in their remarks than the prepared remarks of the invited guests.
Liz, this is the last hearing on the lease plan. What happens next?
Right. The scoping period, as they're calling this, ends June 19, and they're supposed to publish their draft environmental impact statement in the fall. And if they stay on track, Joe Balash said that he expected that the lease sale, if there is one, would take place in April. It's kind of a funny process here because most of the opponents to drilling came and just want to talk about their opposition. They don't want any kind of drilling, but Congress has already mandated that there be lease sales. So the comments that, well, we just don't want any drilling there, it's kind of like Congress has already decided that. So they don't have specific information, enough specific information, the opponents, to say, well, don't drill in this part or, you know, this area. They just don't have the kind of specifics that might guide the process. So it's kind of a funny sort of hearing, considering that Congress has already mandated one.
All right, Liz. Well, thanks for being at the hearing and covering it for us today.
Sure. Thank you.
There are no tumbleweeds blowing through the streets of Southeast Alaska towns, but the region has received a lot less precipitation than usual over the past 9 months. The National Weather Service held a webinar this week about Southeast Alaska's drought. KRBD's Layla Carey listened in and has this report.
Southeast Alaska is the kind of place where you can get a lot of rain but still be in the middle of a drought. It's home to the Tongass National Forest, the largest of about a half dozen temperate rainforests in the world. Communities scattered through the lush evergreen forest measure rainfall in feet. Ketchikan is one of the wettest, with about 12 feet of annual average precipitation. Rick Toman is a climate scientist with the National Weather Service.
Drought is one of those things that it seems like, oh, everybody knows what a drought is, but the more you think about it, the harder it gets to pin down.
A drought is a deficiency of precipitation over an extended period of time. The deficiency level and time period can vary, Toman says, and whether or not it becomes a drought also depends on how much demand there is on water resources by people and the environment. Considering all those variables, Southeast Alaska is in the middle of a drought. It started last fall, following a wetter than normal summer. Ketchikan, for example, received record rainfall levels in August, but then...
Starting in September, we see that precipitation at Ketchikan totaled a little over 11 inches. Doesn't sound like a drought to me, being a Fairbanksan. Sounds like an awful lot of precipitation. But by Ketchikan standards, that was actually... it was below normal.
Normal in September is closer to 15 or 16 inches.
October, again, over 11 inches of rain, but that's well below normal in Ketchikan in October, followed by well below normal precipitation in November as well.
October usually sees 15 to 25 inches of rain. A typical November is slightly under that, but similar. November last year, though, was around 8 inches. December and January went back to average levels, Toman says, but then February and March were dry, again by rainforest standards. All that means overall precipitation in Southeast Alaska since fall has been below normal, by a lot. October to March also was the driest for that time frame. Rainfall in April and May improved the situation somewhat, but a deficiency remains. Aaron Jacobs is a senior hydrologist with the Weather Service's Juneau office. He says that deficiency has had an effect on the region. Jacobs says a drought also affects community drinking water supplies, seafood processors, and the natural habitat of the entire forest. Salmon have a difficult time spawning when streams don't have enough water, Jacobs says, and yellow cedar mortality increases when rainfall is lower than normal. So what will happen next? Well, Toman says there isn't a clear signal at this time.
We do have increasing signs of an El Nino developing for this fall and winter, and that often has a significant precipitation signal in Southeast Alaska. So at this point, I would say as we get moved towards the wet season for Southeast, stay tuned.
And as rainforest residents know, keep your rain gear handy. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Father's Day. Father's Day celebrates the dads in our lives, but for some, it's a reminder of pain and loss. To deal with that pain, the organization called The Dinner Party connects people grieving the loss of a loved one. This Sunday, they're sharing stories on social media from the thousands of dinner partiers all over the world whose dads have died. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell has our story.
Kemi Miller is standing in her kitchen over a bright blue pot of boiling water. She says she wants to be clear about one thing.
I don't fancy myself a cook.
Instead, she says she likes to experiment.
And usually when I experiment cooking, it just means I get a bunch of stuff from the refrigerator and I put it in a pot and I see what happens. But this time I'm actually following a recipe.
Chicken Florentine. Kemi turns to the sizzling pan on the side burner.
Do you like spice in your food?
I do, yeah.
All right, let's add some kickin' chicken.
This is just the second time I've met Cammie. Both meetings began with a hug. We were first introduced over email by The Dinner Party. It's an organization that connects people in their 20s and 30s who have experienced loss and grief. Becca Bernstein is The Dinner Party's community organizer.
My mom died in November of 2015, and I found The Dinner Party on Thanksgiving Day in a CNN article, like 2 weeks after she died.
Becca hosted dinners for 2 years before coming on as staff.
We're in over 100 cities now across the world, everywhere from California to Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Becca says the organization realized a lot of dinner partiers who lost someone they loved had specifically lost their dads. So this Sunday on Father's Day, they're publishing stories on social media about some of those dads.
At some point, people stop asking, and they shouldn't stop asking, right? Those are stories that are like deep inside of you, and like there should still be a way for those to come out.
For Cammie, a lot of those stories she has with her dad are about birds.
We'd go to the marsh and just look at the ducks and the geese.
Cammie says police have even pulled him over. He could get so distracted, she says.
But he's like, oh, I'm just looking at the geese.
Oh my God.
And like one time I was with him and I'm like, oh my gosh, Dad.
Because he's like swerving around.
Because he's swerving and he's like looking up like, oh, I can hear the flock. Like, where are they? Where are they? Oh, there they are. And then swerving back around.
Sitting around the dinner table, Cammie tells me about a trip to Alaska her dad took right after retirement. It was a dream trip, she says. He came up for a whole month in the summer of 2016. Cammie shows me a photo of her dad. He's got a salmon in his hands and a big smile across his face.
He's like, you know, I'm always the person who doesn't catch the fish. You know, like there's always that one person who it's like, come on, like, get a fish. And he was always that person. He's never caught a fish in the ocean. He was the only one who caught a salmon on that trip.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
On her dad's last night in town, Cammie called to see if he wanted to get dinner to cap off the great month. He didn't pick up, so Cammie drove to where he was staying.
And so I opened the door and then he just looked so like helpless, you know? And I think my dad's never helpless. He always has the answer. He's always the one that you call when you don't know what to do. And he just looked so fragile.
Sudden cardiac arrest. Cammie's dad was gone. The next few hours were a blur, she says. The police showed up and asked if there was someone they could call.
You know, my emergency contact is my dad. You know, it's like, in that moment, I felt so alone. Like, no, who do you call when your dad dies?
But as the first person to find out about her dad's death, Cammie did have to make a phone call. She had to tell her sister.
And she's like, not my dad. My dad doesn't die. Like, he doesn't die. Like, our dad fixed everything, like, knew everything. You know, he doesn't die. Like, he's never going to die. I think that was worse than finding him dead.
My conversation with Cammie is different from most of the interviews I do because I'm not just here as a reporter. I was on the other end of one of those calls back in October. I remember being on the phone saying, no, 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 it can't be.
All right, Dad. We're filming.
That's a video of my dad a week before he died.
How are you feeling?
Okay. I'm out and I'm walking.
Shuffling, you mean?
His white t-shirt is tucked into khaki shorts. His legs look like toothpicks, but he's smiling. He had just gotten out of the hospital after having a heart attack, and he thought he was in the clear. He, too, died of sudden cardiac arrest.
People right. experience the death of parents, but, like, it shouldn't be when you're, like, a teenager or when you're in your 20s or 30s and, like, right. haven't been married, haven't had kids.
My dad will never see me do those things. Cammie's dad won't either. We talk at dinner for more than 3 hours about what we miss, what we remember, what we regret, and why it's so important to keep the stories of our fathers alive even after they're gone.
Well, cheers to our first dinner party.
And to our fathers.
And to our fathers.
In Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Bruce Gordon in Excursion Inlet. Gordon works as the watchman for the Ocean Beauty Cannery.
Excursion Inlet is about 60 miles west of Juneau as the boat goes and 45 miles west of Juneau as the crow flies. And my neighbor to the west is Glacier Bay National Park. I started coming to Alaska in 1971 with Northern Radio Company. and Wartzko Packing Company hired me in 1976 to be their communications supervisor for the corporation. And Wartzko sold out their Alaska assets in 2003, and I got sold with the cannery to Ocean Beauty Seafoods. Just like a generator or an iron shank, or, you know, just part of the package. There's nobody around except for my local neighbors, and there's never more than like 20 of those at any one time. We had a murder up a cabin at the head of the bay 2 years ago. Because there's no communications up there except for marine radio, I'm sitting in my chair that I'm sitting in now, and I hear this radio call on channel 16. Bruce! Hello, Bruce, are you there? And it was one of the neighbors up there, and he gets on, and he says, I got a kind of a situation, and I need the troopers. And even if we called for a medevac, and they launched the second we called, they're still 45 minutes to an hour away. So your golden hour is shot to hell by the time you get here. And they finally convicted that guy about a month ago.
Bruce Gordon lives in Excursion Inlet. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Russell, Henry Leisha, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Avery Lill in Dillingham, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.